Okay, I will. Thank you. Good evening. I am Wilma Weston, and I am an alcoholic. Hi. And my home group is the Saturday night Evakahe speakers meeting here on the island of Oahu. Yay! I'm delighted to be here tonight. It's a privilege anytime I'm asked to participate in any way in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's amazing. I look over this room and I think, God, we have grown in the years. And it's wonderful to see. I'd like to thank Patty. I would like to thank Marcy and the committee for asking me to share tonight. It's a special, special privilege for me. I don't know whether there's any of you ladies that was at Kansas City 25 years ago. If you are, give me a shout. Yay! Well, I'll tell you, I was privileged to speak at that meeting 25 years ago in Kansas City when it was snowing like hell. And to be asked to come back and speak, that is very special. And the fact that I'm still here and still sober, hey, I found such joy, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I better say that before I tell my story, because you won't think I've loved anybody in my life. Especially this time, it's brought back a lot of memories, because I talked to a lady tonight that's known me all the time I've been sober, and we talked tonight. Her name is Joanne, and we talked tonight, and I got good news and I got bad news, because some of us have to move on to that other meeting, and it's a miracle that we're here. It hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink or any mind-bending chemicals since March the 22nd, 1969. Yo! I know there's some ladies in here that have a longer time on the program, because I have 44 years, God willing, next month. On March the 22nd, I'll celebrate 45 years. I'm so happy. I don't say that to impress anybody, but I'll tell you, every morning I wake up, it still impresses the hell out of me. Because I look in that, two things impress me now. The fact that I am still breathing, and that. It used to be just that. Now it's, I'm breathing and I'm still alive. I'd like to tell you, ladies, that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 15 years old, got the message, and I've been here ever since. Well, that's not true. I wasn't even thinking about you then. 20? No. 25? No. 30? No. 35? No. I didn't give up, I'll tell you. I hung out there as long as I could. I'd have hung out longer if I had realized that God was going to save me. I'd have doubled up on everything. But I didn't know he was going to do that. So I came into Alcoholics Anonymous at a little bit over 38 years old. So I am now 83 going on 84 years. Thank you. And least I forget that my hostess, Donita, was so nice to me. I'll tell you, I kept saying, I don't need anybody. I'm from this island. You don't need to show me Diamond Head. You don't need to take me around. You don't do anything. Let me tell you, that lady was persistent. I mean, she came over with all these goodies and brought me water and brought me And I'm looking at all this stuff. I said, what am I going to do with it? Little bags of this and that and all the goodies, you know. And I'm thinking, I won't eat any of that. Well, let's see. I've had two breakfasts, and they're all because of she brings over these goodies. I got Oreo cookies. I got little cupcakes, banana bread, you know, all the stuff I'm not supposed to eat. I was eating it away with my feet up watching television this morning. So I tell you, it's so nice of you. Thank you very much. And you know what AA does to you? AA has a funny way of doing things to you. Because I kept saying at the committee meeting, I don't need a hostess. And then I was told, well, it's not for you. It's for her. She needs to be in service. I mean, they really know how to get to you. So I said, well, of course, you know. What are you going to say, hell no? You're going to say, of course. They just know how to pull your strings. It's amazing. But it's been the nicest experience. And just being here in this room tonight, it's a marvelous experience for me to think that 25 years later, I'm able to stand here to tell you that the program still works, and there is such a magic in this program and the power that this program has. And it has. It's changed my whole perspective, my whole viewpoint on life itself. I didn't come in whistling Dixie and say, oh, in 69 I don't have anything better to do, so I'll run out and join the most unpopular group I could possibly find. Not the tennis club, not the golf club. I'll just sneak into Alcoholics Anonymous. Because in those days, everything was downstairs in the church. And then, I tell you this, because I hadn't thought about it in years, but I thought about it. I woke up with a start a couple of weeks ago and thought about it. The first time a few times later, I said, if it's Alcoholics Anonymous, why do they put this little sign out that says Alcoholics Anonymous with an arrow on it? So I'm looking around the room that night, and I said, well, I couldn't be the only professional thief in the room. There's got to be other people. But the next week I went and the sign was still there. The next week I wore a cape, like, affair. I pulled that little sucker out of the ground and as I was walking off at night whistling, put it in the back of my car and said, that'll take care of that. If we're anonymous, why would you put a sign out there with an arrow? But then the next week I went to the meeting because there were mostly men at the meeting. And the secretary simply got up and said, somebody stole our sign. They didn't say confiscated. They didn't say, you know, something nice. They said, our sign was stolen. Will you bring it back? And I swear I thought that guy was looking at me. In those days we smoked, so I took my cigarette holder and put my cigarette in it, and I'm looking like this. And he said, we need the sign back by next week. And I kept thinking about it and thinking about it all week long. I was giving dictation to my secretary and she's saying, Ann, and I'm thinking, that damn sign, it's in the back of my car. So what I did was I did take it back, but I didn't fess up or anything like that. I just sort of dropped it about 3 hours before the meeting starts. I swear he knew it was me. I just swear it. But that goes to show you what kind of background I came from. I guess I was always a loner. I have no idea why I became an alcoholic, other than the fact that I drank. It wasn't, well, you know, a lot of people have other reasons. They came from a bad family, they came from this, they came from that. I don't even have an excuse. I don't have that kind of excuse. I guess I was kind of an odd kid. And I was always odd. I don't remember this. I don't know how people can say, I remember when I was 2 years old. Hell, I don't remember a thing. Huh? I'm just telling you what my family told me. My mother said I was so ugly that at 3 weeks old she hadn't shown me to anybody. Now that's pretty ugly when your mother isn't showing you to anybody. I'll tell you that. And after a while, and when I grew up and they used to laugh about that, I took a look in the mirror and I said, they're absolutely right. I wouldn't have shown her to anybody either. But I came from a loving family. I didn't know it, but they all loved each other. I was the ninth girl. There was nine of us girls. Matter of fact, there was 17 of us kids that lived. And so we had a rather large family that the warden, my mother, governed over like a warden. But when I was a little girl, my mother said to my father one time, she said, we better take her to the hospital. And he wanted to know why. And she said, well, she's getting older and older, and she's not walking. My father said, oh, she walks. My mother said, no, she doesn't. If you try to stand her up, she just flops down like that. She won't move. We know she crawls around, but no walking. And she doesn't like anybody in the room with her, because when I put her sister in there, she beats her up, pulls her hair, and takes her bottle from her. So they kind of left me alone. Well, that evening, my father comes home, and he comes into the room to see me. And just like a little dog, I knew that it was getting time. I don't know how, but I knew it was getting time for my father to come home. And he came home, and he asked me, he said, come. And I got up, and I started to walk towards him. Oh, was my mother upset as she was peering through the door, because I was pretty big and pretty heavy. And she's lugging me around in the house, and I'm doing my thing. I never put my arms up for anybody to hold me. You know how little kids put their arms up? Not me, only for my father. I didn't really care about, I guess I didn't care about anybody else, because I didn't put my arms up. And when they gave me any toys to play with, I accepted them, but I just didn't play with them. But if my father gave me a toy, I played with that toy. He was the apple of my eye. My father lived to be 102 years old, and he was a beautiful father. He stood about this high, and I could eat soup off the top of his head. But he was a loving, kind man who I admired. And one day, after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I understood that I loved him. I didn't understand that before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just knew that he made me feel safe, and he made me feel good, and I always waited for him to come home. And I was just a loner. I never played with toys. I didn't play with little dolls, little teddy bears, and I didn't even like them. Matter of fact, it's difficult for me to like kids. But anyway, didn't like them, didn't care about them, didn't do anything with anybody. I was just a loner from the time I was a little kid. Was I predisposed to be an alcoholic? I don't know, because I hadn't had a drink yet. But I could have been. I knew that I didn't fit in. I mean, God, I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous 44 years. In other states, we have people's birthdays, we sing happy birthday. After all of these years, going to all the meetings that I go to, I can't carry a tune. I cannot even sing happy birthday. I just don't have a ear for it. I really don't. In my family, there was no televisions. You see, I came along before there was televisions and things like that. We were poor, and I didn't even know we were poor because it was the Depression. Everybody was poor. So we did other things, like they got together on Saturday night, and I had a sister that played a cello, another sister that played a bass, and two or three of them that played the piano and the violin, and there was me. So they gave me a couple of sticks and said, just hit them down, keep time. They took the sticks away from me and said, can't do that. I couldn't play any of those things. I couldn't play the piano. I couldn't do any of them. They were just having their little sessions on Saturday night playing Lilacs in the Rain or whatever it was. And I didn't even like the sound of it. So I would just sit there and watch them all as they did these things. Oh, they just had a great time. And I was always the kid who couldn't quite fit. So I just lived my own life. And I got used to living that way. And I have lived that way most of my life. My life is a very private life. And the only way that it does become not private is when I stand up here at the podium and tell you that I stand here only through the grace of a loving Father. And I truly believe that with every fiber of my being. Because of myself, it is not possible. It is not possible for me to have done this for so many years. Because I didn't seem to care about anything or anybody, and I hadn't had my first drink yet. I didn't dislike my family. I just didn't belong in a household of people that seemed to get along very well, because I didn't. There wasn't any pictures of me because I never had a smile on my face. They gave me a doll and a doll buggy, and I thought, what the hell am I going to do with this? So I took it up to the third or fourth story and I hid it. I was afraid to throw it out because if the warden caught me, I was going to pay a heavy price for that. But I did get rid of it. Somebody said, what happened to your doll buggy? And I looked and said, I don't know what happened to it. And I thought, I'd get rid of that damn thing. Oh, it's going to go. So I never played with dolls, never had any toys. Just didn't. I wasn't a kid anymore. I just wasn't a kid. I don't know how to tell you other than I guess I best describe it by saying that I've always walked to a different drummer. I never heard what they were all doing. I just knew that I didn't belong there. I was like the kid that goes to the candy store and looks in the window. I never seemed to have enough to go in. So I just looked from outside. I don't know whether I had enough feelings to even envy them. I just went about my business and I did my thing. And I hung around my brothers because they just let me hang around if I didn't say anything. And I didn't say anything. And so they let me hang around and watch them fix their cars and other things. And I watched them put in universal joints in their cars and this and that. And then my other brother would say, you want to come? So they would go down to the store to buy parts for their car, and I'm watching him put the clutch in, shift the gears. Oh, that's the way you do it. And then at 11 years old, he made a big mistake. He left his keys in the car. I said, I got you. I got in that car. I did grind the gears just a little bit because I hadn't quite adjusted the clutch. Those of you that are young don't even know what a clutch is. Put that car in gear and took off. And I ran right up on the curb across the street. Pulled out of there and went down the street. And, of course, when I turned the corner, I ran up on another curb. Didn't hit anything or anybody. but I did, and I knew I was going to get it when I got home, and I didn't care. I was willing to pay the price. I really was. And from then on, it was hell. Nobody left their keys in their car because I was going to drive it. I don't care how many twigs and how many branches and how they made me, my mother would make me bend down because my father never hit us at all. The warden took care of that. And I didn't care. I just loved the thrill of driving. And I hadn't had my first drink yet. It's amazing. But I did find out one thing, that that I just wasn't like them. They all seemed to get along. They all seemed to understand. On Sunday mornings, I used to sit around and think it was Grand Central Station. I didn't know who these people were and what the hell they were doing. So to entertain myself, there was a Presbyterian church across the street. My mother was a Catholic and my father was a Buddhist. So my mother is Mexican, or she was Mexican. She's dead now. She was Mexican. My father was Chinese and Filipino. They were all little people. I came in a house. I was 10 or 11. I was 11 years old, and I was 5'7" then. My brothers were only 5'7", and they were grown. And the rest of the family, I'm looking down at them. Always look down at them. So they knew something was wrong with me. And my mother said that they should take me to the children's hospital because I was growing and they thought I was going to be a giant or something. So I just, and I wore already size, I mean, in those days, no girl wore a size 9 shoe. Now it's just a regular size. Before, all these women were little. I don't know, they didn't get enough vitamins or milk or whatever it was, but they were all little and wore 6s and 5.5 and 7 with a whisper. A 9. They call my shoes, because I was tall and skinny, so they call my shoes gunboats. And every time my mother did have enough money to buy me a pair of shoes, they had to be very narrow, which made them even look longer. And then I was skinny, so I was called olive oil. Well, after a little while, they were calling me Popeye. I had a propensity to be insulted by that. So I had to back it up. One day I was at school walking across the yard, and where I had to go to lunch, and these girls were eating their lunch on the stands there, and they always made fun of me. They called me steroid sticks and all sorts of things. And one day I was walking by, and the stick was laying there on the ground with the nail in it. I picked up the stick. I must tell you, I had bad intentions. I picked up the stick, and I was just walking along with it. Now, there was a teacher there, and they should have, that's bullying, and they should have stopped them. But they didn't. This one girl in particular, she came over, and she started taunting me as I went to the thing. And I'll tell you, I got that stick, and I went crazy. I mean, they said I went crazy. I was just so mad. I'll tell you, she never called me Popeye again. No, she never called me olive oil again, and she left me alone. And I was in such a rage because the principal came out, and I gave her a good bite in the arm and chased her. And then they sent for one of my older sisters, and I gave her a real big bite, and she let me go. And then they threw me in a room. And when they threw me in the room, I jumped out of the window and I went home. And the reason I went home is to tell the warden. Because you don't lie to the warden. So I went home and I told, my mother says, "What are you doing here?" And I told her that I had gotten in trouble and what happened to me. So she took me back to school. And the principal said, "Well, you know, she's going to have to be paddled or whatever. And my mother said, no, she's not going to be paddled. Well, you don't know. She may be lying. She said, she may lie to everybody in this world, but she doesn't lie to me. And I kind of liked that. My mother stuck up for me. And she said, I'll tell you one thing. If she hadn't, I would have come back to school and they would be wiping you up. You would be a grease spot news in the paper. Great, Mom. But I'll tell you, from then on, I was a crazy. So nobody bothered me. When they think you're crazy, they leave you alone. They don't want to have anything to do with you. So I just toddled on through. But the alcoholism or the disease or whatever it was, or my perspective on life, wasn't that great because I wasn't succeeding at anything, really. I didn't really care. Sunday at that Presbyterian church, my mother always made my brothers sweep up. She's Catholic, and she's making them sweep the because they didn't have enough parking, so they parked along our street because we had a corner house, and they would take up the leaves and cut the pepper trees off so the people could go to their church. And I'm going, what are they doing? My mother said, well, we want it to look nice because the people are going to church. And I thought, really? So I'm sitting out there with these long pins, hairpins. So I decided to make myself a symphony. So I go over and I take the air out of your tires. Zip. But then I thought, one tire isn't enough. So I would take it out of two tires out of one car. And I had them all along the street. It did. It sounded like I could almost get a baton and just play the music. Zip, zip, zip. They were just having one hell of a time, huh? And I'm sitting out there, and almost comes time, I go take my hairpins out. Well, they weren't my hairpins. They were my sister's, but I took them all out. And I'm watching these people as they come out of the church, all dressed up, hats and gloves and everything. And I'm sitting there on the back porch watching them, and they're in despair because two tires are gone. My mother comes out. She makes my brothers help them. And then she says, I wonder how that happened to all of these cars on our side of the street. I'm looking, and she said, did you have anything to do with it? And I said, I don't feel good, Mom. I got a stomachache. I know that would get her attention. She said, do you feel feverish? I said, yeah, I really feel feverish. She said, go in the house. I didn't have to answer her. Oh, God. But from then on, there was no more concerts. I lost interest in that in a hurry. But it sounded wonderful. It took them a few hours to get them cars out of there. I was delighted. I said, maybe they won't park over here. My brothers won't have to cut down the trees and clean up the thing so everything will look nice for the Presbyterians over there. But that's how my life started out. And then the good part came. I started just doing my own thing. I didn't join anything. I wasn't a part of anything. My sister that's a little older than I, that's still alive, she was Miss Goody Two-Shoes. Oh, she was in everything. She had these long curls that hung down, 32 of them. My mother used to go, shh, 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 and roll them out for her every morning. And she was just the apple of everybody's eye. And then there was me. She was this big, and they'd say, as my mother rolled us out, they would say, oh, she'll get better as she grows older. They're looking right in my face as my mother's introduced them. She'll be better when she gets older, I thought. I'm not supposed to say this in mixed company here. Me and the tape, I'm not supposed to say this. That's the mixed company. But anyway, I thought about it. I thought, they said, she'll grow out of it. And I said, oh, my God. If I grow another inch, these people are going to have a heart attack. So I decided at not quite 14 years old, I needed to go. So I left home. Just like that, no big deal. I went to my father, and I told him, and he asked me not to, but I know I needed to go. So I left. I told him I didn't run away from him. I just left. I figured the warden was too busy trying to marry off my sisters. So in those days, you married them off. You just didn't go live with people. You married them. Marriage certificate, okay. No marriage certificate, no deal. So anyway, she was busy doing that, and my father said to me, of all my girls, because there's one thing I should tell you. I knew my father loved me. Above all, I've always knew all my life that my father loved me. But I do know this, that he didn't prostitute his home or his family for me. When I told him I was going to leave, he asked me to stay. And he said, if there's anything I can do, I'll send you home. Well, I didn't know. Maybe that'd be China. Maybe that'd be the Philippines. But he said, I should have known something was wrong. You just need some help. Let me help you. We won't mention this to your mother, but I'll see that you get help. And I thought, what does this little man really know? No, that's my first choice. He said, if you leave, you will have dishonored our house. And if you do that, you no longer have my protection, nor will you ever spend another night in my house. Now, he didn't hate me when he said that. He said it because he was head of his house. The little man was head of his house. And he wasn't about to prostitute his values. And you know what? I try to teach that to the girls that I sponsor. I try to teach them, if they are single mothers, they damn well better be head of their house, not their kids. I will tell you that. Because I'll tell you, kids will press the button. They'll push the guilt button until they're 40 years old and you're getting ready to die. And they're still pressing the guilt button. Well, I wouldn't have done that, Mom, if you had been a decent mom. Well, really? Or you used too much, or you drank too much, or you did this, or you did that. And they just keep pressing the button. How long do you say, yeah, it was my fault that you're like this? When do you tell the little shit that he's, the little guy that he's that way? Could you erase that from the tape? Well, I left home. I did. And I understood what my father said and meant. And he didn't change his mind. He never changed his mind, and yet I always knew he loved me. I could go there. I could visit with my dad. I could do all those things. We could go to Chinatown together. But when night came, I better have a place to stay. And people say, well, he couldn't have loved you. I said, yes, he did. He loved me more than most people have the capabilities of loving, because he understood, coming from the Buddhist religion, that I had to find it within myself, that he couldn't find it for me. Of course, I didn't understand that until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys told me it was an inside job. How simple, huh? I should have listened to him when I was 14. But then I wouldn't have had all that fun out there drinking and running from the cops and going to jail. I would have missed all that fun. So that's what I did. I left and went to San Francisco and started drinking and started smoking cigarettes and finding a way to live. I didn't seem to have a problem because I didn't feel alone. There's only one time I really felt alone, one Thanksgiving, when I was getting ready to go out. And you're a group of women, and I know you'll understand this. Sometimes it's hard for me to talk about feelings, but I was dressing, and it was Thanksgiving. And I looked in the mirror as I was putting on my makeup, and I was thinking, there's no place in this world I'd rather be than just to be at home and sit down and have my father pat me on the shoulder or on the head. And I just felt that hole inside of me getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and there was nothing I could do about it. And I had that awful feeling like when you're trying to swallow and you can't seem to swallow because it's a big, tight knot there. That's the way I felt. And I thought, I'd give anything to be able to do that, but I can't. That's, I cannot do. So that night, I took extra time to make sure that my makeup was on perfect, that the seams in my stockings, we wore seams in our stockings, they were nice and straight before I went out to drink to help close up that hole that was inside of me, and I didn't know why. When I went to San Francisco, I sat down on a bar stool and nobody asked me how old I was. I was just an old person. So I sat down on the bar stool and I didn't know what I was going to have. I just heard the music. I heard the music from outside and I kind of liked the sound of the music. So I went in there and the bartender said, well, what do you have, ma'am? And I looked over and the guy was, I said, I'll have what this gentleman is drinking. That guy should have been in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you that. Because he was drinking straight shots of vodka, Blue Label, that's 100 proof vodka, with a water back. So I said, well, I'll have that. I didn't know anything about martinis or the drinks with all the fruit and flowers. Oh, I'm glad I didn't. That's bad for your stomach. All that acid going down in there, all those oranges and lemons and stuff. So I took the drink, and you know what? It didn't say to me, oh, you've reached the elixir of life. This is what you're going to do for the next 20-some years. You're going to sit on a bar stool and drink. It didn't say that at all. It just, I drank. Oh, it burned as it went down. But you know what? When it got there, I felt a little okay, a little bit better. So I drank a little bit of the water. I didn't fall off the stool. I didn't go into a blackout. I didn't do anything. But I thought I should have a cigarette with it. Oh, boy, what an experience. I drank and I started smoking and other things came along in a while that you do when you do those kind of things. I got a job. I went to work. I lived in Chinatown because my father had sent me there. So when he threw me out, he kind of gave me a little edge. He said, go there and they'll know that you're going to come and they'll see that you're okay. So I lived with this family who was very, very nice to me. And I did what I wanted to do. And I found out that the drinking made me like people a little bit. Never liked them before. When I drank, I didn't like them either. So, you know, I was a lot better, though. I was a little bit nicer. But I continued to drink like that for better than 20 years or more of my life. That's how I drank. And I drank with great intensity, and somebody asked me when I was sitting in a bar one night, they said to me, oh, by the way, I didn't drink in low-class bars. I've been one who said, I want to look good when I'm drinking. So that's what I did. I set a value for myself. I didn't live in... Well, I lived in Chinatown, but when I stayed in there and I started stealing. I found out that the store that I was working for didn't let me out in the front. They made me work in the back cutting these tags off of lingerie, or the strings that they were sewn all together, so you know that was cheap stuff. But I would cut them off and put the tags on them. Then I got so one for you and two for me. Sometimes two for you and one for me, especially if I didn't like the style. So, you know, and I would tag them all up and get them all looking nice. And I'll tell you, when I left San Francisco, I could have started my own cheap lingerie shop. I had all these pants and all these, what am I going to do with all them damn things? I had them galore. So I said, oh, okay. But you know what? The thing became very obvious, that I thought the world owed me something. I didn't think they paid me enough. I didn't think they respected me enough. I didn't think this. I didn't think that. I got my paycheck, and then I started doing other things. I found out that if I went in to this regular drugstore and had a sandwich and carried a book with me, that they got so used to seeing me that I could put that book on the shelf and take a new one off. Because, see, they got used to seeing me with the book. So I would go in and have my liverwurst sandwich with a Coke and read my little book. And then I would kind of look around to see what was going on. I never stole anything else. But I got so that I was so good at stealing those books because I said, you know what? They're so accustomed to seeing me. And I found another way to do things. You keep doing the same thing for a long enough time, people get accustomed to seeing you. Never occurred to them that I was stealing their books. But I left them something in return for it, an older book. It's just the way it was. So I found out that stealing intrigued me. And then I found out that when I drank, I needed money to drink. Well, since I wasn't going to drink in cheap places, that meant I had to look at least decent. So then we had to figure out on how we're going to do clothes and things. Well, I found out that you can do the same thing. You go into the same store and they know you. Pretty soon, they don't even watch you when you go in the dressing room. If you would sit on something, oh, yes, I'm going to. Then I discovered that if I had a twin sister and we went into the stores together, not together, but the same store, she would have a different sales lady and I would. And they would say, your sister was in. I said, really, what did she buy? So I started stealing under one name and then stealing under the other name. It was rather interesting. Because her sales lady, I would walk by her like she didn't exist. I would want my sales lady. And they would say, well, she's not here today. I said, really? Oh, okay, I'll leave. But Mrs. So-and-so helps your sister. I said, no, my lady knows what I want. I'll be back. It got to be a game. It got to be a wonderful, challenging game. And that's how I existed, by doing those kind of things. So I didn't have time to think. I didn't have any time to do that. I spent all of those years sitting in bars. Now, I promised my father when I left that I would go to school and get my high school diploma. Well, in San Francisco, I didn't do that. So I needed to come back to Los Angeles, and I did. I came back to Los Angeles, and my father said to me when I went to see him, he said, and where's your, oh, I didn't do it. He looked at me. He said, if you're going to come over here, you need to do that. So I said, okay. So I entered night school, and I graduated. I didn't learn much, but I graduated. So he was happy with it, and I was happy too. Then I started running drugs. Well, I was a runner, really, for... I'm part Mexican, and you know what? I'm a camellia when it comes that way. I mean, I'm living in the barrio now, huh? I'm living in East Los Angeles and going, ¿qué pasó, huh? So I started running drugs. Well, the runners, I don't know what they call them today, but those runners take chances. They do not take chances. These people are making the money, and you're taking the chances. So I said, why don't I get myself a connection, and I'll start doing my own stuff here. So I did, out of Mexicali. I was going to Mexicali all the time, and I met this, I got introduced to this guy who made it pretty easy. I came across the border. I made my connection. I paid him his money. He gave me my material. He said, you'll go to 6 or 7, whatever it was, at between so-and-so time, and he'll take you right across. He'll let you go. Okay, but you have to be within that certain time. So I figured he's got him paid off. And so we did that for a long time. It was working smooth. But you know what? Alcoholics, there was no drama. Alcoholics can't stand that kind of stuff. So one day the guy gives me the look. He's smiling at me, and he gives me the material, and I get ready to give him the money, and he puts his hand on my eye. He said, "Do you have time for a drink?" I thought, I got time for a drink. Let's see. I've got the merchandise, and I've got the money. I can always get another connection. I go to have a drink with the guy because I've looked over the bar. And there is a way out, another way out. So I have my friend with me. We're out. We're on it now. He was in the car. The merchandise was in the car, but I still had the money. And I had a drink. Then I had two drinks with him. And then I excused myself to go to the restroom. Well, he didn't get to where he was by being dumb. When I left that bar, I had gone out the side door. He knew I was gone with his money. Do you know he was unhappy? He was so unhappy that he started to follow us. And when he followed us, he actually was shooting at us. So I said, "Do you think, Gene, we can make it?" And he said, "I don't know, but I'll tell you. When we turn another turn out here, I want you to jump out of the car." I said, "You want me to what?" He said, "Jump out of the car." I thought, I've seen that before in the movies. Okay, I'll do that. He said, "Then you're going to have to come across the border on your own. You've got money, go do it. I'll take care of my, I'll do my own thing." I said, "Okay." I jumped out of the car, and to my surprise, I didn't look like those ladies who got up. My false eyelashes were coming off. My body was skinned up on the side. There was gravel. That Mexicali grava is not only red, but it's gravel. And it was embedded into my leg and into my arm. And I tell you, I looked a mess. I thought, this is not the way it happens in the movie. She just gets up, shakes it off. There's not a hair out of place. Her eyelashes were still on. It took me 3 days to cross over to get back into the United States. I mean, I became an expert in si, seguro que si, and all my little Spanish things, huh? Oh, Jesus. I got across the border, but I was infected pretty bad. My leg, my arm, it was already beginning to smell. That's not good. So they had to take me into emergency and clean out all of that stuff. And they wanted to know what had happened, and I said, "Well, I was doing a run on a bicycle mountain, and I fell." The guy is looking at me. It's flat land there. He's wondering, where in the hell are the mountains? Huh? So, I did. I got back. I didn't know whether my friend Gene had gotten back or not. He obviously did get back. But you know what? When I was leaving, I didn't say, "God, if you get me out of this, I'll never do it again." I said, "God, if you get me out of this, I'll never go to Mexicali again." I didn't say I wasn't going to do it anymore. I just said I wasn't going to Mexicali to do it. Well, I haven't been to Mexicali since. So that's what I started doing. I started haunting the bars, and I started being able to sell on my own. And in those days, it was tough duty because the cops were on you in Los Angeles. And it wasn't the nicey thing like it is now. Now you go to a party and they have a silver tray. And it's lined up and they're saying, "Would you like some?" Not in those days. So I wasn't a drug user. I was an alcoholic. But I liked the money because it did something for me. It not only allowed me to dress good, but it allowed me to buy things for my mother. I bought her, most of you won't remember these things, but I bought her a radiator that goes in the floor, those kind of radiators. I thought she would love it. She hated them because she said the kids were going to come over and they were going to get burned on those things. Well, I said, every modern house has radiation coming out. Not, she didn't want them. So everything I did, she didn't like. But I thought, this will show her I'm okay. Well, you know what I came to find out? She wanted me okay. But it wasn't for those things. Not at all. She just wanted me to be all right, and I wasn't all right. My drinking progressed rapidly. But I wasn't out of control. I was not out of control. In this sense, I was able to hold down a job. I'm good? Oh, okay. Well, I'll tell you what happened to me. I found it necessary, because they kept putting me in jail all the time. And so I hired an attorney. And when I hired him, he was a noted criminal attorney. And he charged me $5,000. That was a lot of money in those days. That was on a retainer, of which he said, you will never get back again. But I will remember your name if you call. I said, okay. And he said, I'll tell you what the police don't know. They're not that smart. So don't start volunteering. If you don't have to volunteer your name, don't give it to them. If you do, give them your name, and that's it. Don't explain anything. Let them figure it out. So pretty soon, I don't care who you are, you're just not that smart. Pretty soon, I got a bad reputation. I can't imagine how, but I got one. They started taking the seats out of my car. They were checking for contraband. That's what I called it. Contraband. They called it drugs. So, oh, okay. But they didn't find any. They knew it was somewhere, but they didn't find it. Well, at 2:30 in the morning, when you're wearing a long dress and it's hatless and you're looking good and they're taking your seats out and they can't find, and they don't put them back in, you're in trouble. So I said, how about putting my seats back in my car? And they looked at me like, huh. I thought, uh-oh, trouble. Then they started picking me up, and I started going to jail. I went to every substation in Los Angeles. Now, in those days, you were guilty. Today, well, you've had a bad family, so they beat you, they did this or that, so, you know, a little help. You put an AA book under one arm and a Bible under the other, and they say, oh, poor thing. In those days, you weren't a victim. You were a thief. You were a drug dealer. You were an addict. You were something. Now they go, oh, bad life. Well, those days, you were guilty until you were proven innocent. So I kept going to substations. In those days, it was 72 without a call. They would move me just before my 72 to another station where I had to do another lineup. Now, I'm not your everyday girl. So if they're looking for somebody, why would they be saying, we're looking for this Eurasian, Asian, Mexican, whatever she is, I'm 57, we're looking for her. There was nobody there that was interested in me. So they were just moving me around because they thought it would wear me out. In a few weeks, you know, finally they'd have to give him my call and he would come down and take care of it, and I was out of there. And he was threatening them and all sorts of things, and he was paying off people. And finally he said to me, you know what, you're going to have to get a different kind of job. I said, a job? What kind of job would you be talking about? He said, a job. He said, are you going to have to do some hard time? I said, oh, okay, hard time, huh? Yeah, are you willing to do some hard time? I said, not really. And then he said, well, I suggest you do something about it. Well, I did. I drank a little bit more and thought about it and drank a little bit more and thought about it. Then I decided, this is another choice, I got married. So, oh, what's his name? Or whoever, yeah, I got married. I couldn't think of anything else to do, so there I was, married now. And that was not a good situation. because I never wanted to be married. I never wanted to have any children. I never wanted to be with anybody. And now I'm married. And he's a gambler. He's not an alcoholic. He's not a drug addict. He's a gambler. Well, that's the worst kind. Because one day you would look out there and you'd have a car, and the next day you wouldn't. So I was had been told long before that I would never have any children. I was delighted. The doctor says, I hate to tell you this, but you're not going to be able to bear children. I said, really? He said, we can get you some help. I said, what kind of help? Well, there are psychiatrists, there's psychologists, there's... I said, are you kidding? It's the best news I've ever heard. So I was felt pretty safe, and I had been. All of a sudden, I get this backache low in my back. So I made a mistake. The warden wanted me to take her over to her doctor. So I said, oh, I'm having this back pain. So she said, well, why don't you see my doctor? Oh, that was not good news. I didn't know it wasn't good news until he examined me. And then he got out this little box with these little things in there, little things, and he started pressing around my stomach, and he said, oh, my goodness, I hear a heartbeat. I said, why shouldn't you? He goes, oh, no, another heartbeat. Then I had almost had a heart attack. I said, you got to be kidding me. He said, yes. How do you feel? I said, well, my back hurts me all the time. But I had only gained 4 pounds. That made me about 115 pounds or something. I said, Jesus Christ. And the warden was there. Oh, God. So I called my husband, who was at the fight. I said, it's an emergency. Please have him paged. And I told him over the phone. I said, I'm pregnant. And he goes, what? I said, yeah, I am pregnant. So I said, I think I can get something done about it, but I was too far gone. That's the honest God's truth. I would have taken care of it had I been, but I was already 5 months and something. But I never had regular periods, so it didn't bother me. I mean, I wasn't throwing up in the morning. I wasn't sick. I wasn't doing any of those things. I was going to work and mind my own business and trying to be a good citizen. That's what will get you, being a good citizen. Long as I was out there and looking at the paper wall, the wallpaper, and going, this isn't my wallpaper, I was all right. I never got pregnant. So, oh, now I know the wallpaper and I got pregnant. I said, Jesus Christ. You know? But I couldn't do anything about it. It was a little late. I was about a month too late to give it a chance, or I would have done it. I really would have. So my son comes along, Arthur. Nice kid. Really nice kid. But I did stop drinking. I didn't have a problem stopping drinking. I just stopped drinking. Period. Didn't drink anymore until the baby came. And once he came, I named him Arthur. And my husband said, what, you named him? I said, yes. You were out gambling, didn't show up for 5 days, so I named him. And I didn't name him you. He's not a junior or anything like that. So that's his name. It's on the papers. Too bad. So he comes home with me. I'm looking at this little bundle of joy here. And I'm thinking, no. I can't tell you what I was thinking. No, I can't do that. That would be really bad for me. Maybe not so much for him, but for me it might really be bad, so I can't do that. So Arthur comes along, and he's just a happy little kid. And I told my husband, if you don't quit gambling and do something decent, we're out of here, or I'm out of here at 6 months. When he's 6 months old, I'm out of here. Never mentioned it again to him. He didn't mention it to me, and he kept doing the same thing. At 6 months, I have my clothes packed. I don't have the kids' clothes packed, but I have mine packed. And then I said to myself, go or stay? Shall I put a coin up there? No, I don't think I should do that. Then I thought about it. Let's see, what's going to happen to him? Oh, no, his father isn't going to get him. My oldest brother will. And our family, the next oldest brother would have that responsibility, or the oldest brother would. Well, I never liked him, my oldest brother. Not a bit. If he's alive, I still don't like him. So I decided, okay, you come with me. So I took him with me, and he's been with me ever since, really. They don't go away, you know. If you think they're going away, they're not going away. They always show up like bad pennies. Here they are. But I stuck him in military school while I was out playing and drinking and doing all these other things. I stuck him in military school as soon as he got old enough. And they didn't want to take him because they didn't say, they said, well, you don't have visible means of support. And I thought, are you kidding? With all these men in Los Angeles, you're telling me I don't have visible means of support? I don't know what you think, but... So they wouldn't take him. So I went to my boss at my company, and I told him what a sad case it was. I lived in a house with 17 other sisters and brothers, and, you know, we were a poor, injured family, and we didn't have anything, and I needed to work. And I couldn't get my son into military school, good Catholic military school, because the president of the company was Catholic. I said, a good Catholic military school. And I said, I really want him to have an education, but I have to work. And now I've accepted you people, and you're going to give me a college education, too, so I'm working for that. And he said, we'll see what we can do about it. Damn near cried when he said, 17 of you? I said, yes, and we only have a few rooms. Well, my father was in the import and export business, and we have a huge home. I wasn't living there anyway. But anyway, he helped me get him into military school, and I kept the kid in there so long, he finally said at 17 years old, can I get out of here? I said, really? What do you want to do? He said, I want to play basketball. I said, oh, my God. Okay, we'll let you out. So he was very delighted to be out of military school. I wasn't, but he was. But that's the way my life went. It went from one thing to the other. One drug deal. When I started going to college, the company gave me an opportunity. You know, there's Eskimos in our lives, and we don't even see them. They gave not only me, but quite a few of our people a chance to go to school and to improve our life. I was running a steam press for 90 cents an hour. Anything sounded better than that, but I was ill-equipped to do anything else. So they gave us an opportunity. We were a rubber company. We were doing magnificent things there, and they wanted competent people. So they offered us an opportunity. So I took an entry examination, and I'm not a smart person. I don't even know how I passed it, but I was surprised myself that I passed it. I hadn't even went out and looked for anybody to do it for me. I couldn't believe that I had passed the test. Barely passed it, but I had passed it. So I entered college. Me, who didn't really want to do anything, I entered college. And I worked my butt off. And it took me almost 6 years to graduate because I had to take classes pertaining to our business. I was still drinking. That's when I started using drugs. I ordered myself up because the dean of women called me in and said that she suggested that I go to a junior college. And I said, what for? And they said, well, you're not equipped to be here at this school, so a junior college, then maybe you could get some of your required subjects. I wasn't going to do that, so I went to East Los Angeles and ordered up 1,000 bennies. I tell you, I was asking questions that even I was surprised I asked. Oh, yes, I was. I'm studying, I'm working, and I'm drinking, and I'm using Vinny's now. All for a good reason. And I'm working, too, because now I have all this energy. So I'm working for the company, too. Instead of 20 hours a week, I'm working 40 hours a week. So now I'm a full-time employee. So when I finally got through with college, I was a full-blown drug addict. And, of course, I was an alcoholic. But then you have to pay a price. There's nothing cheap. There's no free rides. And there isn't any in Alcoholics Anonymous either. You don't come into Alcoholics Anonymous and get a free ride. You know, it's everything costs. And sometimes in order to get things back, we have to reach the point of no return. I drank and I used and I did all of those things until I could no longer do them. The company gave me an opportunity. You're not going to believe this, but I'm the class of 58. That's before most of you were born. I'm the class of 58. I have a degree from the University of Southern California. And I did it, and I kept my son in military school, and I lied, and I cheated, and I did all the other things that one does. Time? Oh, I was just beginning to have fun. How am I going to tell you about what I did in Alcoholics Anonymous? I'm not going to have to tell you what I did in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was staying much too long in my childhood. And alcohol. How much time do I have? 5 minutes? Oh, hell, I could tell you about Alcoholics Anonymous in 5 minutes. I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous with a boyfriend. Well, he wasn't exactly a boyfriend, but he was the only one that didn't ask me what I did on weekends and why I wasn't available. So I did. I came in the doors. I was sitting on the bar stool waiting for him. Now, I got there probably about 10:30 in the morning because he was going to be there at 7:30 at night. So I didn't want to miss him, so I helped him chop up the limes and the lemons and did all that stuff. And I'm sitting there waiting for him. He walks through the door and he says, I have to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, oh, Jesus Christ, you have to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous? What's that? And it never dawned on me that that's why he couldn't find his 1969 Continental. He would call me up in my office and question me, do you know where my car is? And I thought, well, why wouldn't you know? Hell, I was taking Vinny's and everything else. Of course I would know where his car was. So I give him a fat clue and he would find his car. Well, he said that night, would you go with me? And God did for me what I could not do for myself. He brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I came with him as a visitor. And I left believing that I had a problem. Now, I honestly put on my little white gloves, drank up my drink, because when it was got about time for him to come, I'd ask for a vodka mist instead of a straight shot. That's just vodka in a glass with a little bit of ice in it. And so I would drink that when he got there. And I swear, I sipped that last drink, put on my little white gloves, because I'm an executive now, and I slipped off the bar stool, walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous on Ohio Street, and I have never had another drink nor another drug. I came off of drugs. I came off of alcohol. And I'll tell you why. Do I have 2 minutes to tell them why? Okay. You know what? A woman came up and walked up to the podium, and she said, my name is Ruth, and I'm an alcoholic. And she looked gorgeous. She had on a black velvet dress and long streamers and a bow in her hair, and it was shiny. And she told her story. And I swear she'd been reading my mail. Honestly, I thought she had. And after the meeting, I saw the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. When people came up to shake her hand, especially the guys from the vet's place, she didn't look down at them. She looked at them. Not like they were less than she was. I knew for some reason she didn't believe that. And you know what the woman had the nerve to do? She walked up to me. I'm a visitor. She walked up to me and she tells me the one thing that was going to save my life. She told me, "You don't have to drink anymore. You can get off the train now. You don't have to go to the end of the line." And you know what? I looked in her eyes and I knew she was right. I knew she was right. That's why I take the time to come and to present myself in a manner that honors her, that honors the fact that she took the time to come down to a meeting where it was a veterans' night, but she looked so nice. And she meant what she said. I can't tell you what I thought of her, but I didn't drink anymore. I was to kick one more time. I can't tell you how many times I've kicked cold turkey. I kicked cold turkey. Never had another drink, never had another drug, and I fought my way through Alcoholics Anonymous, through death, through pain, through everything else. And let me tell you, in 44 years, there's a lot of that. I'm standing before you tonight with a knee replacement and pins and rods in my back and in my arm. No, life isn't always easy and you don't always get it on your terms. But I will tell you something. There is a power and a magic here. If you find it and you stay here, all it asks for you is a little willingness. Just a little, not a lot, but a little willingness. And I'll tell you one thing. I've never took a vacation from Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never taken a leave of absence. Never once. I didn't come into Alcoholics Anonymous and have you put a Band-Aid, and then after the Band-Aid falls, you're telling me, "Well, you know, you're getting into my business." I picked them off the goddamn floor, and now they're 90 days later, "You're getting into my business." They don't have a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out of, and they're telling me that? I'm not a happy camper. That's why I'm not the best sponsor in the world. If you know why I'm not? Because if you don't want to do anything in your life, find somebody else that'll pat you on the head. I'm not going to do that. Not doing it. I found a way to live that's unparalleled to any other way. 164 pages of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous has altered and changed my life to a degree that is totally incomprehensible to somebody like me. That's what you have given me. You have given me life and a new perspective and a love for this program. And I'll tell you, it's an unselfish one. Because everybody that I sponsor, I only want the best for them. Could I have 2 more minutes? Can I have 2 more minutes? I want to just tell you this. The tape is going to run out, but I want to tell you something. One of my babies that are sitting with me tonight is, she had to have a lung put in, and I went to the doctor. That's what sponsors do. That's what we're all about. We're not just all about patting you on the head. And I told her, if you're fortunate to get another lung, I will come. You just call me and tell me. And I was at the doctor's, and he said, "You have a rotator cuff that's torn front and back, and you need surgery." I said, "I can't do it now, doc." He says, "Why?" I said, "Because it's getting close to harvest time. It's getting close to Thanksgiving and Christmas, and that's when they harvest a lot of body parts because we're too stupid out there." So, you know what? She got one. She got a lung, and she called me up. And I got the first plane I could off of this island, and I was standing at her bedside in San Diego. And she said, "You came." And I said, "Yes, I came." And then on Thanksgiving Day, she said to me, "I've ruined your Thanksgiving." I said, "No. You've given me the best Thanksgiving I ever had. This is the best because this is what we're supposed to do. I'm your sponsor and I made a promise to you, and be damned if I'm not going to keep it. You have given me more than I will ever give you. Your love, your kindness, and your patience, and your tolerance. And I am indeed privileged to sponsor you. Thank you, Michelle. Thank you."